And do you have a vacancy for a back scrubber?
For a back scrubber. Hey, this is the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, and right now I want to let you in on the fact that Clayton and I, we've been friends for a very long time, and that means that we have accrued, perhaps more so than newer friends might have, a long list of inside jokes. So I'm going to test you right now, Clayton. Mm-hmm. Do you know at any time in the event of an emergency, what is the signal? If I were to say a line of dialogue from a movie, what is the signal?
Well, that's the signal. Right? From Naked Gun?
I would refute it. I would refute it. The actual signal is to say, I love it.
I love it. I love it.
That's the signal.
That's the signal.
Yes.
I find that you and I often just say, that's the signal, and truncate it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you're right. I think that's from the first Naked Gun movie, when the O.J. Simpson character, whatever his name is, right, he's trying to get out of the back of the van because Frank Drebin's calling for him. That's the signal they set up on the wire, was that he would say the phrase, I love it.
And then he's trapped inside, like the telephone pole is keeping him from getting out of the van.
They back the van up against a telephone pole and they can't get out of the van. So Frank Drebin just keeps getting frisked by whoever the bad guys are, and he just keeps screaming, I love it! I love it! And no one's coming to save him.
Do you have other inside jokes that I'd be keen to test me?
Do you know what kind of beer helps you save more?
Sip and save beer.
Sip and save beer. That's right. It was very popular in our hometown.
You and
sip
I,
and save beer.
Yeah, you and I made a home video.
Mm-hmm.
It was just some random little commercial that we put in between the home video.
Right. Yeah, that was in the famous. There was one where. All right, we're really getting deep into it now. Clayton and I really disliked the Bryan Adams song, Everything I Do It For You, which is from the Kevin Costner Robin Hood film, right? Of what, like 1992? Does that seem about right?
Seems about right.
And so, for reasons unknown, during a David Letterman-esque program that we had made, Clayton and I, as a duo, a Bryan Adams-like duo, played Everything I Do It For You. Or perhaps more accurately, we lip-synced it.
Right. And it was brutal.
It is. I mean, that song is brutal, as was our rendition. Mm-hmm. But as you may recall, what was unique about that particular home video of ours, which included Sip and Save Beer, is I think we had, like, you and I didn't own that song, but your sister had the cassette single. Is this coming back to you? And the single version that was released to cassette varied from the version made popular and beaten to death on radio, in that it had like two extra minutes. Like there was this additional instrumental that was not part of the radio version. So we thought our little spoof was over, and we were about to get up off the chairs that we had with the keyboard and whatever else we were maracas or whatever the heck else other instrument we had. Only to discover that we were far from done. There was a lengthy synthesizer solo that we were about to embark on, and we had to make it seem as if that was intentional.
It was really bad. It was like a two-minute. I mean, it was like a two-minute random keyboard playing.
Yes.
Right. It was. It was like, and then it would pause, and you thought it was done. Do you recall at one point during the home video you and I made, we got up. Right, like
that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh,
we thought
like
it was over.
Right, you got up. Or we both. No, the best part is I think I started walking away, and you were still on the keyboards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was on synth.
And I
that's
walked,
what we said.
But I was like holding a guitar, and I was just wandering around shirtless.
That's right. Yeah, you were topless for that video.
I was topless, and you.
But you know, you were always very tan. Whereas I was not. You could get away with that. Less so me.
Right. I mean, it was really, really bad. So we thought that the song would end.
It brings a tear to my eyes just hearing it, Clayton.
We thought, okay, this is going to be the end of the song, right? We're like, walking away, and suddenly.
Right, yeah. We had the quick sit back down and continue doing it.
Right.
You know, that really for me launched an era that spanned at least a decade where I just hated everything Bryan Adams did. I hated that song so much I could not enjoy anything else that he made because, he's got that really kind of like, I don't know, I think that is like a raspy whiskey voice he's got.
Gruff. Yeah, he's got that.
Yeah, and I really, really, I couldn't stand Bryan Adams stuff for a really long time. But I will confess to this. I do like his song, Can't Stop This Thing We Started. I might not even be getting the title of it exactly right. But most of his other stuff, I really can't stand. He also had that really kind of schmaltzy super team up with Rod Stewart and Sting later in the decade for a similar movie.
Called All for Love.
Yes.
And that was
do you like that song? I mean, especially given that we're kind of Sting fans here and maybe indifferent to Rod Stewart. Does Bryan Adams destroy your ability to enjoy it?
Yeah. It wasn't even that. It's just the song I didn't like. I mean, just the... you know, here it is. I mean, this is a little bit of it.
Oh, you have it handy.
From the wind and the rain, from the hurt and the pain, yeah, hey. Let's make it all for one, all for love.
Pretty bad.
What year is that from? Like 96?
Well, it's from the Three Musketeers soundtrack, correct?
Oh, God. I don't know when...
The Three Musketeers soundtrack. And I'm not sure when that came out. But, yeah. I think, and actually, that may be Sting's biggest solo hit. Or no. Well, maybe I'm wrong about that. But there is some little trivia. Like
his longest charting single as a solo artist or something like that?
Yeah, because he has writing credit on it, of course. Right. He's lumped in there. Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart, and Sting. So, but no, I never liked that song. Although right. I do have like a Sting Movies CD.
Sure, Sting at the Movies. Yeah, yeah. It was a double disc import that Best Buy somehow always had in stock.
Yeah, so you know that's on there, and there's some Sting has done some really good movie soundtrack songs. That not being sure. one of them, but that right. being but that being agreed. One of his biggest hits, though. Yeah, I don't know. It's really really cheesy, but
right. Yeah, that's kind of crazy. Yeah, you know the weird sort of thing like that of you know in the same way like the biggest I think continuous chart success of David Byrne's solo career is a club hit called Lazy that. Like if we were to compile like 30 must hear David Byrne solo hits,
mm-hmm.
like Lazy, which only ended up then I think they put it on the album Grown Backwards as a bonus track because it became a club hit. Like it did really well on the dance charts.
I don't think I've ever even heard that song.
Right? Oh, it's completely forgettable. But that's like you know it
here
falls
it is.
Into that.
And that was a hit because it was hot in the clubs? Is that the deal?
Right, yeah, it was like a huge club hit. And like it spent more weeks on any Billboard chart, no, probably Club Dance Electronica was the chart or whatever, than any other David Byrne solo hit because it was like in that, you know, the summer that came out, that was like a big club hit. Yeah, you know, strange bits of trivia.
Speaking of music, you and I haven't really talked about some albums we picked up lately, but there was a lot that I wanted to chat with you about. It was making mental notes throughout the week. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to tell Mike about that. I'll save it for the Grizz. Picked up the new Shins record.
Ah, you are quite the Shinem. The last Shins album you had sent to me, I remember that. There were quite a few. They came in rapid succession from you. The Bees was another one right around the time that you sent me the Shins.
Yeah. Did you? I think that was one of my favorites, Wincing the Night Away.
Yeah, you were quite the advocate of that. I liked it. It was okay. But I don't think it struck a chord with me quite the same way it did with you. You and I went through that, too, with Kings of Convenience. I think you were, like, really into Kings of Convenience, and I was just kind of lukewarm on it.
Yeah, they're very Kings of Convenience is a very acoustic group, the duo, and it's interesting that they had a new album maybe, like, a year and a half ago to 2 years ago that I really disliked. It's very painfully boring. Wincing the Night Away in 2007, yeah, I was a real big fan of that Shins record. But the new one just came out on March 20th, Port of Morrow, MORROWO, by the Shins. Really, I really like it. I'd say I like the first part of the album maybe perhaps better than the latter part of the album, which tends to happen because I think I end up listening to the beginning portion of an album more often. You know, hit play, and sure, so I've grown to appreciate that.
You don't usually start listening to an album at track 5.
Yeah.
You start at track 1.
That's a good point. You're always on top of things. Here's a little I like this. Here's a little. This is called Simple Song. This is probably my favorite from their. That's called A Simple Song off of their new record. I didn't realize they won a Grammy for Wincing the Night Away, actually.
Oh. Huh. Hey, real quick, any of the record labels that we've infringed on thus far in the episode, at Grizzly Produced,
right.
You're going to want to hit us up for royalties there.
Actually, but because we managed to keep it under 30 seconds,
right.
It's fair use. Fair use. That's so right. We get to play it for you. It's a little treat. And hey, we're promoting your music for crying out loud, you know?
Right. Be an idiot. There's always a fine line, but Clayton is correct. If we do keep it under 30 seconds, legally we're in the clear here. But nevertheless,
right.
You know, a while
I'm keeping my eye on that clock, by the way.
I know you are, too, because if you don't know this, you know, Clayton, who's observed on a global level as the host of Fox and Friends on the Fox News Network, you are more mindful of those types of broadcasting issues than I am. And obviously, I can't have you turning up on the front of the Daily Star. You know, like them taking you away in handcuffs, which I think is they'd be so angry about those 12 seconds you just played. Right. You'd
really
be taken away by the feds.
Meanwhile, the shins would be happy, but yeah.
A while ago, though, we did off air. We had a discussion about that, and you know, really, if we wanted to play longer form content, we would need to get the approval of the artist. And on occasion, we have a good recent example of that is Thomas Dolby. Who was kind enough to come on the program, I don't know, 2-3 months ago, whenever it was.
Yeah.
Having just released an excellent album, and it worked out really well because, not that we have tons of guests here on the program, but when we do, we've been really lucky in that we haven't had to have somebody on who just released something that we hate.
Right.
Like, no offense, but, Clayton and I are 20-plus year fans of They Might Be Giants. But if we had, for whatever reason, you know, through a time warp or whatever, if we'd had to interview John Flansburgh right after John Henry had come out,
yeah,
that would have been a really difficult interview to do because all I would want to do is tell him how much I hate the new album. Whereas, you know, when we talked to them and Join Us had just come out, like that was like the best thing they've done in at least 10 years, if not 15. So, I was really delighted that worked out the way it did. And I wanted to mention this, too, about Thomas Dolby, who was really gracious when he was on the program and everything else. He had talked to us about a North American tour that was upcoming. And guess what? It's happening right now. Thomas Dolby is on tour. Not a lot of dates, though. As you can imagine, if you heard the interview, that guy is busy with like a million different things.
Yeah, I saw the email come into our inbox, I guess, or our mutual inbox from Thomas Dolby's agent, correct?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I kind of like to stay in touch, with those folks just to let them know in case something were to come up, or especially on those cases when, you know, we've had a couple guests come on more than once. Michael Uslan, for example,
right.
Has been on the program more than once.
By the way, did you order his book? Because his book came out in the fall, but we didn't have him on since then.
Right,
the
yeah,
boy
totally
who lived Batman.
Slipped my mind. That's strange that didn't make more ripples on the type of comic book sites you and I frequent.
Right.
I don't know. I'll look into that in a second. But in any event, I wanted to tell you really quickly. By the time this reaches your ears, it'll be too late if you live in Toronto to see Thomas Dolby. But later on this week, he's in Michigan. He's coming to Chicago, Minneapolis. He's in Portland, Oregon next week. He's also coming to Vancouver, Seattle, San Francisco, Sacramento, San Diego, and Los Angeles. And that's it. There are no other dates right now that I know of. Where there have been made public for Thomas Dolby's tour. So I don't know if we just got on the train too late here, but I was really, really hoping that he was going to come somewhere near us because I do enjoy that new album of his so much.
It was surprising how good the album was. I was a little scared. I mean, here's the guy who did She Blinded Me with Science, mm-hmm. You know, in the 1980s, and then...
Indeed, he did.
Of course, not a big fan of that song, but... That's
right.
What he's most notably, that's what he's most people know him from. But yeah, this album is really, really good. I found myself listening to it nonstop on the subway ride to and from work, and really good. If you haven't picked it up, go check it out. What's the full title of that album again?
Map of the Floating City.
That's right.
Is the name of it. You know, that kind of recalls, I don't know if we talked about this on the Grizz about like those 80s comp songs you can't get away from. Have we
right.
discussed that here?
On the Grizz?
Yeah. Is that just something we talked about, you and I, without anybody recording us?
No, I think a couple of months ago, you and I chatted about extensively about that, actually, and we kind of ping-ponged some different ideas. In fact, the other day I saw one of those albums. And you and I were having lunch the other day at that Dairy Queen. I was looking at one of those CDs on my iPad. You know, I was just playing around the iTunes store because we were looking at Paul Young stuff.
Paul Young, yeah.
And he was on a compilation of 80s stuff. And I thought, here are your throwaway songs, right? Here are the
rockin' hits of the 80s. Tony Basil's Mickey.
Dead or Alive with She Spins Me Right Round.
I
was surprised there was Police stuff on this particular.
Right, it was a weird one, that one you pulled up.
Oh, I know why. You remember why? Because it was an iTunes Essentials collection.
Yeah.
So it wasn't published by a company. iTunes just had all those songs in their collection and then curated them in a way that was palatable, I suppose.
When we last discussed this, it only just dawned on me because I heard this playing in the King of Prussia Mall food court a few hours ago. One of those that I forgot that definitely falls into that like rock and hits of the 80s compilation is Cars by Gary Numan. That's on like all of them, and I don't ever need that. Like, I have such a harsh aversion to that 80s one-hit wonder. Like, and I'll tell you a weird thing. A friend of mine, his name is John. I used to work with him during my Golden Eagle Comics days. He was one of the most soft-spoken men I've ever known in my entire life, and had some really esoteric tastes in music. Among his favorite artists, I mean, he seemed to know everything about them, were Thomas Dolby, Gary Numan, Falco, and Men Without Hats.
Wait, like, now that, who is this?
This is my friend John from the comic store, and that's not to say his musical tastes were limited to that. In fact, he liked the Talking Heads, and he liked They Might Be Giants, and he liked lots of other acts that I also liked. But he had like all the albums. He was exceptionally knowledgeable about and those are, you know, especially when I worked at the comic store, which now was back in the 90s. It's not like now where like in two clicks you just Wikipedia up information about Men Without Hats and you can talk about them as if you were an expert. But that also calls to mind, isn't it in the iTunes Essentials or something like that, where the Falco collection excludes Rock Me Amadeus, his most famous hit?
Yes, because I was looking around for that not too long ago, and I couldn't believe that it was in there.
Right, how did you miss that one? Like, and you had the nerve to call it Essential. What are those other ones? Vienna Calling, which is like a distant second hit for him. And then, what was that song After the Fire covered? It was originally Falco's. It's the only song they're known for. Der Kommissar.
Right.
That's another one, isn't it? After the Fire's version of Der Kommissar. That's another like rockin' 80s comp.
Oh, sure. Like, that's always on there. Der Kommissar. What else from... Well, I mean, Rock Me Amadeus.
Well, I don't know. Like, that one, you know... If you get some of the ones that are a little more comprehensive, that's when like Shattered Dreams shows up from Johnny Hates Jazz. But like those are the ones that always leap to mind, right? Like Mickey, She Blinded Me with Science, 99 Luftballoons, Cars by Gary Numan. Those are on all of those.
And then some, you know, like In a Big Country.
Yeah, that's a very good example of that.
Of course, I love that song, so that's not one I'm worried about when that pops up there. But you're right.
Like, I'll tell you a strange thing about it. I don't have the studio version of In a Big Country, but I have a concert version. I bought this random CD. It was called, like, The 80s Live, and it was a bunch of, like, one-hit wonder-type bands, and it was just them playing their one-hit wonder live. That was it. Like, I got that. Did I ever send you that? I have a live version of Lessons in Love by Level 42.
A live version?
Yes, I do.
Send that for right away. I love that song.
I know. I got that. What else is on there? I Melt With You by Modern English was on there. Night Ranger's Sister Christian being performed live in Tokyo in front of a largely apathetic Asian audience. Like, all kinds of really weird. And then, if anybody else has this one out there, you're going to know exactly the CD I'm talking about, because it was like it was in the dollar bin, and at the end everyone else is just represented once, and then you get to the end. You remember Taylor Dane?
Mm-hmm.
There's three
of hers. My ex-girlfriend looked a lot like Taylor Dane.
Really?
Do you remember my old girlfriend from a few years ago, Abby?
You know, I never met Abby.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird. She looked a lot. That was a period when I lived like some part of random part of the country. But yeah, she looked a lot like Taylor Dane.
Okay.
That's
all right.
Weird. She used to get that a lot, actually. People would be like, yeah.
No, you know, there was that period there where there were a couple I never really met.
Yeah, you didn't miss much.
All right. There's three Taylor Dane songs lumped at the end of this. Like, who owed her a favor that she got triple what, you know what I mean? That didn't make any sense to me.
Or I would see a lot that have, like, The Outfield shoved in there, too. Mm. Like, Your Love and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. I like The Outfield.
You know, there's always, though, that 180s compilation that has, like, a fairly decent amount of, you know, there's some decent songs in there. You know, like, right. I want to be a cowboy, but, like, Boys Don't Cry.
I love that song. You know what's, I'll tell you what's a real guilty pleasure of the 80s. This was the one, like, when I would go to the junior high dances, I would act like I didn't like it, but I secretly did. Do you know the song Waiting for a Star to Fall?
Oh, yeah, that's by...
Because Boys Don't Cry did I Want to Be a Cowboy, but Boy Meets Girl did Waiting for a Star
Waiting
to Fall.
Waiting for a Star to Fall. I like that song. That is a guilty pleasure. Ooh, that would have been a good one. Here's I Want to Be a Cowboy. I haven't heard this in a long time.
Oh, this is a great one.
It's a lot like that.
I'll tie this right back to something. Before I knew who the artist was growing up, I thought that was a Thomas Dolby song.
It sounds a lot like it, something he would do.
Right. Of course, like, I mean, it's got all those weird, quirky sounds going on in there. And, like, you know how in his most famous, of course, there's that guy in the background going, science!
Science!
Like, the voice of the guy singing that, I thought it was that guy.
But I guess what I was going to say is, I mean, other than, like, the One Night in Bangkok, you know, you get, like, Murray Head shoved in there.
Right, but that's a rare one to find on 80s comps, I feel.
Really? I feel like I had, like, three 80s comps that had that on there. I don't know why. Who knows? But there's always, I guess the point I'm making is there always was, at least on a few of the compilations I had, it was the most annoying thing ever. But it was there was always one of those, your favorite songs that you hoped was, you know, you got it because you thought that was the case.
You thought it was the original.
And then it turns out being it's a karaoke hit. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, yeah.
There was a ton of those. I remember, like, West End Girls.
Mm.
I bought – there was, you know, because I didn't have, I think, the Pet Shop Boys Greatest Hits at one point. But then right. West End Girls I wanted. But then I found out it was a karaoke version I got on some comp.
No, I feel you on that one. I definitely have one of these upstairs. I have this obnoxious collection of CD 80s comp type things. I got one home that it did. It had a rarity on it that was, like, really unusual. It was, believe it or not, the Greatest American Hero theme by Joey Scarberry. And by the time, like, on the back of the jewel case or whatever, the insert, you know, those are called J cards, right? On the back of the J card, it listed the time. And you know, there's two versions, right? There's the version that aired with the television show, which is like less than 90 seconds long, but that was also a number one hit single, and the time of the full single is 3 minutes 15 seconds, give or take. So I picked up this 80s comp, and it had it on the back, like, believe it or not, theme for the Greatest American Hero at 3 minutes and 15 seconds, or whatever that exact time is meant to be. And I thought, oh my god, this is it. I've looked everywhere for this full on, you know, this of course predates iTunes and things like that. So I bought it and I got it home. What I didn't read on the front cover was, perhaps you too have fallen victim to this, it is not performed by the original artists. These are 80s hits being performed by some random band of studio people, like singing it like a choir.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And I was like, oh, how did I get this?
Occasionally, you know, like our audio guy on our show will bump, you know, we'll bump to break, a commercial break with playing a song, you know, and then we'll put on the screen the name of the song and the artist.
Right.
So the people at home can, you know, go and purchase it if they want, or if they're interested. They don't have to, like, write it and say, what was the name of that song? And whenever we play Beatles, you know, because I'm such a Beatles aficionado,
yeah,
I'll yell out in the studio, I'm like, this isn't the Beatles. And, like, one of my co-hosts will say, yes, it is. Of course it is. I'm like, no, it's not. And then they'll put it up on the screen, like, who it is, and it's like, the Beatles tribute band, you know, because we don't have, for whatever reason, you can't, I don't know what sort of ASCAP law
right. You can't
there is.
Get the actual Beatles songs.
Yeah, for whatever reason, they just don't allow you to do that. So we have to play, like, fake Beatles, which drives me nuts, because I instantly know that it's not them.
The Starlight Vocal Band performs the Beatles.
That might even be the name of them.
That is a real, there really are. Like, if you Google up Starlight Vocal Band, you'll find stuff by them.
Here's one for you. See if you can figure this one out. All right, I'm going to play a little song. I'm going to play a karaoke version of a famous song.
Oh, boy.
Now, you should be able to get this. I'm going to give you 5 seconds to get this.
Is that
this.
It? Oh, boy.
5 seconds. And go.
Well, that, of course, is Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads.
Karaoke. I wonder how much those guys make. You know, the karaoke guys?
Right? The karaoke guys. What do you mean the guys?
Well, I mean, right? I mean, you got to think that it's not like the Talking Heads released an instrumental version for karaoke purposes, right? It's like session
musicians. I don't know how that I have no idea how that works, to be honest. I'm really disconnected.
I'm off to the
that.
Studio today. Oh, are you cutting a brand new album? Are you working on are they doing something special? No, we're doing karaoke versions of Miley Cyrus today.
Right. How weird that you said that. I was going to say Achy Breaky Heart. That's so weird that you said Miley Cyrus.
You know what I mean? I just wonder how much I bet they make some decent money. I bet some of those session musicians make bank. And I think some of the country music session musicians really make bank. In fact, our buddy, our mutual friend, Jim Harold,
yes,
just recently did a conspiracy theory, conspiracy
album?
Corner show with an author of a new book. I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but I actually pitched it at one of our meetings because I thought, oh, this would be a great segment. We got to get this author on. He contends in his book that in the 60s and 70s, that on the biggest hits of the most songs we know by heart and sing regularly, whether they're Eagles hits or otherwise, I suppose. I don't know because I haven't read the book. That 90% of those songs are not performed by the artists we think they are. That the people that are playing the music are actually session musicians. And there's a group of them who played on most of the classic hits that we think are played by the bands that we love.
Right.
But no one ever knows their name. No one will ever know, you know. But he's revealing, I guess, the story in this book, which I think is fascinating.
Well, let me say this. I've done zero research into this, really. But I think 90% is a crazy number. But let me also say this, dating back to something that you and I first kind of experienced. And I'm going to tie this to a recent episode of The Trending Show. Here's where the conversation starts. Are you aware on the most recent Trending Show that your wife put forth the idea that the Beatles were a boy band?
I listened to the first half of this week's Trending Show.
And you had a good sense to get out early. I'm of the opinion, in the true sense of what a boy band is, that is to say that they're a group assembled to satisfy certain corporate interests, regardless of what their individual talents might be. The first real boy band is the Monkees. You know, they were put together by Cole Gems Records to star in a television show, and then also happened to make them into a band. It just so happens that two of the members came in able to play musical instruments. You know, Nesmith and Tork could play.
Well, let's start backwards here, because how would you define a boy band? I mean, that's the starting point, right?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, the Beatles were more of an organic band in the real sense of it, in that they each brought some kind of real musical talent to the table, right? They each could play an instrument. They learned to play together as a band, and their main goal was to make Beatles music.
So they were brought together. I guess that's the key, right? They were brought together by some sort of manager.
Right, they were right, exactly.
In an effort,
as you know, like,
to
the
sell,
Monkees auditioned for parts on a television show where they were to play a band. It was a sitcom about a band.
Yeah.
And they only really then later turned into a band. And of course, I'm sure for people who grew up with that, that was always the big knock on the Monkees, because in a famous interview that he gave at the start of one of their tours, you know, Nesmith outed them and said, "Tell the world we're plastic because we are." Because they were rebelling against the control of music supervisor Donnie Kirshner at the time, who really didn't want them involved in the musical process. He wanted them to come in, cut their vocal tracks over top of what the studio musicians had played, and then get back onto the set and keep making the TV show. And, you know, of course, that didn't sit well with the boys. And later, by the time Headquarters came out, they really did morph into a real band. Like, Jones and Dolenz learned to play as they went. But from the outset, they were cast as actors in a television show. And this really kind of came into Clayton and my sphere, as we remarked at the top of the program, we've been friends for a very long time, when a guitarist by the name of Michael Deasy came to our high school and gave a speech, like class was dismissed and everyone was brought into the auditorium. And this guy, how would you describe him? Do you remember this day? He was like a washed-up Neil Young-esque, his luck rocker.
Man, I can't believe you remember this guy's name.
Yes, I remember. Well, I'll elaborate. This guy came, I think maybe as like part of some public service thing he was handed by a judge.
He had to come about not doing drugs or something?
Yes, you're exactly right. He had to come and speak to school children about the dangers of doing drugs. And he did his whole bit with his guitar over, you know, he had like the strap around his shoulder and stood there with his guitar so you knew what he was supposed to be, I guess, as opposed to who's this hobo.
Right.
And he rattled off a list of all the bands that he had played guitar on session work for, including the Monkees. But it was a long list of all bands that we knew the names of. And when he was saying that, I was thinking, is this guy for real? Like, maybe the Eagles was one of, you know what I mean? I'll tell you exactly who was one of the other ones, Buffalo Springfield. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, is this guy just making this up?
Right.
So when he was done speaking, you know, he's like, if you want to come down and talk to me about my life and drugs, I'm available. So I was like, I'm going right down to quiz this guy on the Monkees. You know what I mean? Like, well, we'll see what's what here, Mr. Deasy. So I went right down to him and I struck up a conversation with him because there weren't a lot of other high schoolers interested in speaking to him. And he told me the exact names of the Monkees songs that he played on. Well, at the time, Rhino had just released a beloved box set for both Clayton and I called Listen to the Band, of which Clayton's was stolen
right
during a break-in. That was back in Pittsburgh, right, when your dorm was robbed?
Yeah, I came back from Christmas break, and they had rifled through. I had two different sections of CDs, one in like a swing-out cabinet that I sort of had my prized possessions in there, and they went in there, unlocked it, took all the CDs out of there, including that Monkees box set.
Yeah. It was a four-disc, and while it was the most comprehensive thing of their catalog that had been compiled at the time, it's since kind of been trumped by some other projects. And Rhino's discontinued it. You can't get it anymore. What was of most interest to me was inside there was a huge book about every song that the Monkees had recorded and who played on them. And sure enough, when I looked through it,
really?
That guy's name was everywhere he said it would be. Because it gave full listings, you know.
Wow.
Like, here are – and you think about what some of those songs sound like. And right now, like, my son likes a couple Monkees songs. So every once and again, he'll say, you know, put on one of the Monkees songs. He likes the theme from the Monkees and Last Train to Clarksville and Papa Jean's Blues. And he'll say, you know, put on one of the Monkees songs. And you listen to those. Like, Papa Jean's Blues is a great one, right? That was sort of like that early triumph for Nesmith. He got one of his own songs on their first album, and he plays on it, you know, even though all the other ones are by studio musicians. I think he plays on Sweet Young Thing also. But you listen to that, and you think, these are so simple, right? It's not like, what would be like a good example of something that's like from the other end of the spectrum? Like, it's not like when you listen to Rusted Root, and you're like, I think there are 31 instruments being played here, right? Like, there's the guitar, maybe bass, but not always. Percussion, maybe somebody's on, like, the Moog synthesizer or the Hammond B3, and that's it, right? And maybe Davey on tambourine.
Right.
But you'd look in this book, there were 20 dudes that played on that track. So I do believe some of what you were saying there about that, that Jim Harrell bit, in that I think that was a much more common practice than people let on about. It was just that, like, that was always the anchor, you know, or that was the albatross around the neck of the Monkees, is that they were so, you know, in that middle period trying to say, it's not us playing this. We're trying to take control. We want this to be us making the music. And
right.
And Rhino and their archivist, whose name, if I'm not mistaken, is Andrew Sandoval, who really probably has more information about that band at his disposal than any living human being. He somehow got his hands on the actual studio, he got his hands on, maybe it was like the pay stubs, so he knew who had been paid to play on which days and could, through his cataloging of what was recorded when,
wow,
reverse figure out which musicians were playing on which songs. But Michael Deasy was true to his word.
That's incredible. And so I did a little digging here for the book. The author is Kent Harmon. The book is called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll.
I have heard of that. That's crazy.
So there you go. So it's not some fly-by-night book. It just came out in February, and there's a lot of people writing here, a lot of different reviews from some big musical magazines and so forth. Like, you know, like, and some hosts of like Classic Vinyl on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. So it says, a fascinating look into the West Coast recording studio scene of the 60s and the inside story of the music you heard on the radio. If you always assume the musicians you listen to were the same people you saw on stage, you are in for a big surprise. There you go. So I guess he points out some things here. I was going to say West Coast. I was thinking it's got to be some
the
some
Eagles
Beach Boys.
Immediately jumped to mind there, of course.
Beach Boys. So from 62 to 75, one group of studio players called the Wrecking Crew provided the tracks for the for records as various as He's a Rebel, Surfer Girl, California Dreamin', MacArthur Park, Classical Gas, Bridge Over Troubled Water. So that's pretty cool. I mean, I'm going to have to read this.
It's very interesting.
I just sent you the link. So, yeah, it's called The Wrecking Crew. If you're into music, you like some of the history there. I love that sort of stuff, the inside scoop on that.
Hey, now, I'm going to throw this out because I said this once to you, and I think you thought I was joking, and I'm not joking. Sometimes, I'm thinking about this now because I can't find this stinking live track of Level 42 I want to send you. I go into my iTunes folder, and stuff that's in my iTunes and it's on my iPod and other iDevices is not in my iTunes folder. I can't find it. It's like it's hiding it from me.
Are you – I mean, you're talking about you're actually in iTunes. You have the software of iTunes open, not on some folder on your desktop.
No. See, that's the thing. Like when I want to find – like let's say there's a song, for example, like you know, when I wanted to play that Thomas Dolby song, you know, Thomas's people had sent us advanced copies of that.
Right.
So I put that into my iTunes folder so it would show up. It would import into iTunes and I could have access to it on my iPod. That's what, that's how all my music gets there. There's no other magic that makes that happen. But then sometimes I go in there to look for stuff, which I know is there because I put it there, and it's gone. It's hidden. Why is that? Why can't I find all the tracks that I put in there? This is it's mystifying to me.
That's bizarre. I mean, because I don't have like a separate folder. You know, like on a Mac, there's an iTunes music folder that's inside the software. Like if you were to go into your files, you know, you're like you click on iTunes, but you know, like on a PC, you double click on your iTunes icon and then there'd be like a bunch of folders in there, maybe movies. Yeah. And then you'd see like your iTunes music folder. Like if I get a new track, I'll just drag it onto the icon of iTunes and it'll just add it. It'll find it that way. Mm-hmm. Because what the software does is it helps you find it. Mm-hmm. So like that overlayer, the nice looking iTunes software that we all use with the cover art and all that stuff, that's just like an easy way of finding the stuff for you.
Right.
So you don't have to dig through like system folders like you appear to be doing. So like if I were to send you a song, you're dragging it into like an iTunes music folder instead of just dragging onto iTunes. See, that's
right.
You might want to try the opposite way, which is just dragging it onto the icon, because then I think it catalogs it, and you know, then it knows where to find it, I guess. Try that next time and see if that works, because I don't usually do that. I just, you know, just drag it right on the iTunes icon, and it pulls it in there.
I don't know. I got to get a bigger iPod soon. I've maxed out. I'm at like 7,300 songs, and I've about maxed it out. I got to get a bigger one.
They have that iPod Classic that they still sell.
No, I got to get something new with like super memory.
Well, it is new. They still make it every year. It's called the iPod Classic, and it still has like a hard drive in it. Mm-hmm. And it's that, I think it's 160 gigs is the size of it for like music files like you and me.
Yeah.
But,
of course, music files is what I want on my iPod. it's obvious, Clayton. It still has dial-up, right?
Right. It's got a modem even inside of it. 56K, you can just plug it right in, and you can jump on your BBMs, too. You can jump on your...
In a minute, we're going to talk about the Silver Hammer.
That's right.
And we are. We'll continue to plumb the depths of our friendship here, because this is it. This episode marks the end of our friendship. before we get too far along here, I do want to talk for a second, because as I am getting quite serious about replacing my iPod, and I do have one other thing here that I need to unload very soon, it won't be long before you'll find me over at Gazelle.com, the recently revamped and streamlined Gazelle.com. They've really been paying attention to what their customer base has been telling them about their desire to re-commerce, so to speak, their used consumer electronic goods. And so they've increased their emphasis, especially on Apple devices, as well as other types of cell phones, smartphones, and some laptops, etc. If you have not been by Gazelle.com recently, please take a minute and go over and visit our great show sponsors. They are maybe the longest standing and continuous sponsor in the history of Grizzly Productions, and that's why we get to deliver this content to you for free week in and week out. Not just the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, but other programs like Daddy on Board, The Trending Show, etc., etc. These are all made possible, and they're made free because we have great show sponsors like Gazelle.com. And one of the best things about Gazelle is they're going to make you money. So go over there, just browse around a little bit and see what those items are that they're buying right now, because you might have money lying about your house or in a shoebox or in a sock drawer somewhere that's just waiting to be converted into cold, hard cash. 1 minute of your time will be well spent today at gazelle.com.
Indeed. You know, one thing sticks out to me. Have you tried, maybe this is something you should give a try to if you're with that large music library. I know I've mentioned it in passing, but using iTunes Match.
Right. Mm-hmm. The dating service.
Right. For people who love iTunes.
That's the only – you know how they always advertise on the – what is that? E-chemistry? I'm not getting it right. But whatever that one is where they're like, we test you on 4,000 levels of compatibility or whatever that's
– E-harmony, yeah.
That's it, yes. iTunes Match is just one question. Do you like iTunes?
Right.
Yes. You've been matched with everybody.
You've been matched with everyone else who likes software, right. For PC software. Which categorizes your music in a way. No, but iTunes Match, if you just get any size. I mean, that's one of the kind of cool things now about any of the, if you like your iPad, you don't have to have like a larger memoried device, because if you got iTunes Match on there, it actually doesn't store any of the music locally on there. Mm. So you could actually listen to your entire library. I think it's a $24 a year subscription to iTunes Match. And it basically catalogs your entire iTunes library, everything you have on your computer, and then makes it available on your devices where you just hit play and, you know, that rare track that you forgot you even had. Like when I turned on iTunes Match a couple months ago when it went live, there were things I was like scrolling through my iPad or my iPhone, you know, tracks for artists or just random. I'm like, who is this? Hmm. This is some obscure 80s artist whom I've only had like one track on there.
Right.
And hit play and it's right there, you know. So, but then you don't need to worry about storing it like on your device. But that's an option.
Well, that's very interesting. I don't know that will help me locate this elusive concert version of Lessons in Love. If I find that, I'll find where the hidden live version of In a Big Country is too. You know, by the way, that the lead singer of Big Country a couple years ago, he hung himself.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. He punched out...
Why is that common among rock stars?
Like Michael Hutchence, right? I always think about that. And people said, oh, they think it was like – do you remember when that happened? They were trying to say that it was actually a bad – obviously very bad, in fact, terminal example of autoerotic asphyxiation. I had to CSI my brain for a second to get it right.
Yeah, where he would put a bag over his head in an effort to get like close to death while climaxing.
Right. That reminds me of that passage in a Malcolm Gladwell book about that phenomenon on a small Pacific island where teenagers were fascinated with suicide, not realizing the finality of that.
Right. That was fascinating, yeah.
It was. Yay, Malcolm Gladwell. When's your next book coming out? I like to read your silly bits.
Yeah,
I find them very informational, find them intriguing.
I've forgotten because I just got a subscription to The New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're a fan of good writing. I don't know that there's a better writing out there. It'd be hard pressed.
Really?
You'd be hard pressed to find. You know how we mock Rolling Stone on a regular basis here on the show.
That we do.
I think perhaps The New Yorker is the opposite of that. And I say that by the types of writers who frequent the magazine, in addition to the great journalists they have there. I mean, they'll write really long form pieces about fascinating news as well, but then they've got great fiction writers, of course, and nonfiction writers who frequent the magazine to offer short stories and such. And David Sedaris is a regular in The New Yorker, as is Malcolm Gladwell. So Malcolm Gladwell will often publish essays there, maybe once a quarter, I think. So I've read some things recently by him, but this is top of mind because David Sedaris just had written a piece about it. French healthcare system. And it was very, very funny. I was laughing. It's hard. I find it very difficult to laugh out loud when reading. I don't find a lot of things funny.
Sure. Yeah.
The written word, I find it very difficult to find a writer that can pull that off. And David Sedaris, I think, is at the top of that heap for me.
Well, something that's fresh in mind, I have to admit, when I page back through them, the initial run of the Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, Justice League International. That stuff makes me laugh out loud. And that's a comic book, of course, but it is the printed word nevertheless. It's so beautifully written, and there's really never been anything quite like that again. I've often described that, by the way, if you're interested to seek that out. That launched in the mid-80s, and they ran on it for 4 or 5 years before a different creative team came on. That really is like the Justice League meets Seinfeld. That's how it's written.
I'll have to check that out. I just downloaded a bunch of Walking Dead graphic novels. So that's next on my comic book list. Mm. My brother-in-law, actually, who I didn't take much for a comic book fan, but who he's out to sea quite a bit because he works for a branch of the military. So he spends quite a bit of time at sea, and he had the trades of The Walking Dead. And he said they are excellent. So, and of course, I've heard the guys over on the Weekly Long Box, our comic book show, talking about that. And they're big fans of it. So I figured I downloaded a bunch of issues on a recent flight I took to Florida. And they are really well done, really entertaining. Of course, the series, the second season just wrapped up, and what an excellent season finale it was. Pretty excited to see where it's going. Have you started watching?
It's actually it's been canceled. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to dive into it yet. Hey, you know, we really got off topic here, Clinton. We were supposed to be talking about the Silver Hammer BBS, and somehow we really got off track.
Oh yeah, so dive back in. And then okay, I got so much. I just wanted. I miss talking to you.
We're gonna split it into two episodes. That's what we're gonna do. Listen, this is what I was thinking of. This is gone from the world. No one will ever have to do this again. Do you remember? Like, whatever, we'd come home from whatever. I don't know why we ever had to stay out late when we were kids. What were we doing? We were sitting on a curb somewhere, right? Like, what were we doing? We'd get home late, and we'd want to get on the Silver Hammer, which was the BBS message board that was, like, you know, one of the earliest forms of the internet to hit West Lawn. And, you know, the dial-up modem would make this horrible noise.
Right, which
would like this. Screeching, and you'd try to find ways to cover the modem to muffle the noise so you wouldn't wake the house up. Because, you know, back then, like, the internet was like $70 a minute.
Right.
So you knew the parents would be hot if they found out that, you know, you not only did you roll in past curfew, but now you're firing up the modem.
I used to grab a pillow and put it over top of the modem in the computer room to get on the BBS, the bulletin board system. And the one that we would frequent was the Silver Hammer.
That's right. So named for my very favorite Beatles song, Maxwell's Silver Hammer from the Abbey Road album.
Right. And, you know, basically, and I don't know if it was the sysop, because that's who usually the system operator that would run those things. They were usually sort of run as a hobby.
Yeah.
And I don't remember, was our friend Ben running that?
I thought that was the case.
Yeah. So he named it that. And, yeah, you would just go on there and you could, you know, it was just an online service. You could, it's funny because if you're say, born in the year, I don't know, what, like 90, 92, somewhere in there, you would have no idea what we're talking about, right? There's got to be a cutoff for people who were using BBS systems. It was, you know, you could post different upload, download software. You could read some news. You could post bulletins or sort of exchange messages. And there was a form of a game that we used to play. Do you remember this? Or I don't know if you ever played it or not, but it was like a space game.
Of course it was.
But we all played it, a group of my friends. We all played it on this BBS where you would – I don't even know how it worked. You would log in and you know, based on your name, your sort of screen name or avatar that you chose, you had some data associated with your name that would enable you to be a part of this game so that you collected a certain number of things, a number of spaceships you had killed or something, what quadrant you were going through. And I almost liken it to sort of like choose your own adventure style, you know, almost like sentence structure. Like, you're entering this area. Do you want to turn left, turn right, collect this, go after this individual? There's somebody else in this quadrant. Do you want to... And you could take a few moves. And the problem was that if you didn't log in for a day or two, you'd be woefully behind. So it's very much like playing World of Warcraft now, right? If you didn't log in
totally
for a while.
Totally unknown to me, everything you're saying.
Really? But I just used to run home, and I'd be like, God, I got to get on. Otherwise, I'm going to be far behind. I'm not going to accumulate experience points. Like, I'll be so far behind, you know.
Is that what it was? You were like, there was no way to win. It just went on and on and on.
I think it was infinite. But it's sort of like World of Warcraft. Like, I don't think there's any way to win. Like, you just keep playing in this world. And you just continue sort of building, and you attack other villages, and you try to whatever, you know, and I guess eventually you just quit, you know, the company who makes World of Warcraft just stops supporting the online infrastructure, which is kind of what happens with most of these games now. They basically tell you that they've got like two servers left that they're going to run for a few more years, and that's it. Mm. You better get your fill of this game because we're cutting it off. That's kind of how it runs. That's kind of how it usually goes.
Yeah, I don't know. Like maybe I just wasn't that. That was that whole BBS. It really seemed to me like a gathering place for you and exactly your peer group. You know, Clayton's a year younger than I am. And I was sort of like the outsider in that group. Like I even at times got the vibe like they didn't even like me on their BBS. That this was meant, you know, specifically for this group. So yeah, I was excluded from some of the reindeer games, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. It was weird. It had like, and the text was always really ugly too. You know, it was like that, like cyan color text, or
right, right.
You know, or like that other turquoise or something like that against a black background.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy!
Anyway. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, just that's such a strange experience. That's so unique to a really narrow sliver of time that will never be recovered. Right? Like, I mean, that can't still exist anywhere. Who would use that? It's so archaic. Like, unless there's, you know, maybe for some reason, like there's a group of people who think the government are out to get them, and that's so low tech
right.
that no one could possibly be bothered to monitor that. Like, that's where they gather to talk about. These are the guys that really recorded the hits of the Eagles and the Beach Boys, you know, or whatever. So bizarre. But yeah, I kind of miss that. I don't miss the noise that the dial-up modem made, though. That always gave me away. I'd always hear my father's booming voice from upstairs. He knew yeah. I was home.
I think BBS, like Craigslist, is like the modern-day BBS.
Mm.
You know, I think it's kind of – or maybe just websites in general. You know, or blogs, perhaps, I guess, you know, would be sort of the modern-day BBS system. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I want to pitch this to you because if you don't know this about us, if you're a newer addition to the Egghead Army here, you don't know that Clayton and I were both McDonald's employees very early on. Among the first two jobs of any real responsibility we were given from that list has already been discounted, delivery boys for the Merchandiser newspaper.
Right.
Because I just in the last few days had the opportunity to taste something new from McDonald's. They rolled out a strawberry and cream pie. And you may know that around the holidays they have a special pie, which the reality of which is sometimes refuted in my house and on this podcast. But the holiday pie is a real thing, and it is perhaps their most delicious concoction. Well, they have a new concoction.
It's like the Loch Ness Monster. No one really believes that holiday pie exists.
I have like my own Zapruder film of somebody, you know, there's a holiday pie and then the president's head explodes. But they have this new thing, the strawberry and cream pie. And I was thinking about this, about the process, because there were some things noted on the box about this. And I want to match this up with what we knew to be true, because I'm sure McDonald's processing of their food has changed since you and I were employees however many years ago that was now, 20 years at least, I don't know.
Right, now they use pink slime exclusively in all of their burgers.
No, they have eliminated the pink slime. They kept the
ammonia.
The bleach, right, yeah, the ammonia. So this strawberry and cream pie, this is what I think. I think, based on everything about it, that it is, at first, once they create it, it is fried. I think it is deep fried, and then it is frozen to be shipped to the store. Because as Clayton and I can attest, everything, you know, basically everything would arrive to the McDonald's shops, the stores, in a refrigerated truck that you'd right. unload in the morning. Everything came in frozen.
Except and for now, the eggs.
Yes, that's a good point, the eggs. And you know what? The lettuce that went on the Big Mac I don't think was frozen either.
Right. It came in a bag, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, and I don't know. Like I said, this was two decades ago. I'm sure things have changed. But it is my – I think this thing is fried, then frozen, then you know, shipped across the country to my local McDonald's where if the process has remained the same since you and I were employees, they have a little oven, like a rectangular-like oven – mm-hmm. on wheels
right.
that heats the pies up to like 350 or 400 degrees for a set period of time. And then they are boxed and inserted directly into my mouth where it scorches off all of my taste buds and renders me unable to taste anything for several days thereafter. And despite all of this, is super delicious. Does that seem right to you that it would be like they would fry it, freeze it, and then bake it? Is that the process you think?
Boy, that's Probably. I mean, like some, you know, I would think so. It would seem, because it's almost, unless it's pre-baked and then frozen and then just warmed up again. Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's crispy. I don't know that it's necessarily fried, but I know
really think about those pies, especially like the crust around the apple pie and everything else. Like, doesn't that seem to you that it must have been deep fried at some point to get like that?
Yeah. Or just overly, perhaps, or just overly, you know, overly baked. Uh-huh. I'm looking here on McDonald's. I'm trying to find the name of this thing. What's it called?
The strawberry and cream pie. C-R-E-M-E.
I don't see it here.
Well, that was rolled out with the new strawberry shakes, which have replaced the shamrock shake. You're too late if you're trying to get in on that. The strawberry one, by the way, I think will give you a migraine. Stay away from it. It's like strawberry quick, right? Like, who wants that in their mouth?
Yeah, I see it here. Oh, there's a review.
A review of it.
Strawberry and cream pie.
Yeah, that's the one I ate.
No, I think it's creme, right? C-R-E-M-E. Is right, that cream or creme?
You're probably right. I just say it cream out of habit. Like, I'm not giving you that one, McDonald's. It's strawberries and cream.
Here it is. It's a new limited time variation of their baked pies. It looks a bit different from the standard apple pie. Instead of having several width-wise opening, it has a long lengthwise one displaying the border between the strawberry and the cream filling. they're promoting
displaying
it.
Displaying the border.
They're promoting it with the strawberry shake,
yes,
which
they
is
are.
Not new.
Yeah, that's everything. I've already unloaded this McKnowledge on you. Come on.
The crust had the same crispy, slightly flaky texture of McDonald's baked pies, but also had a baked-on sprinkling of sugar that gave the crust an extra bit of sweetness. It reminded me to send you the 60 Minutes piece from last night about the toxicity of sugar. But not as sweet as the sugar cookie crust of the holiday pie. Wait a minute. Holiday pie exists?
See?
Inside, the strawberry was mostly like a jam. Not exactly the taste of fresh strawberries. It was a little bit artificial tasting. That's right up your alley. Like strawberry syrup. And gave an even sort of consistent mouth feel. I could see the occasional
consistent
bits of...
Consistent mouth feel? What does that mean?
I don't even know what that means. I could see the occasional bits of strawberries and strawberry seeds, but didn't really notice them in my mouth. Still, I like strawberry, artificial or not. The cream filling was very soft, lightly sweetened, cream cheese-like experience. So, yeah, it was like it looks like cream cheese. It might even be cream cheese.
I doubt it. It would not have gone down easily.
It muted the stronger, sweeter notes of the strawberry and struck... This website is for you.
Oh, my.
I thought McDonald's strawberry and cream pie was pretty good and novel to boot. So there it is.
If they were paying me to write promotional copy for them, I'd come up with something better than consistent mouthfeel. I can tell you that right now.
Now this is a website devoted to brand eating. So this is a review. This is not McDonald's affiliated.
Well, let me put this out there, you know, members of the Kroc estate. If you need somebody writing promotional copy for you, I'm your man. I write a lot.
Yeah.
Most of it's not fit to be seen for public consumption, but I do a good job for you if there was some kind of pie, you know, if the currency in which we trade is pies.
Right, I'll throw this one out to you. See if you can write this on the fly. McDonald's baked pumpkin pie.
Ah, no, I do not eat pumpkin stuff, so that one I would abstain from.
It's a shame.
But I could probably write you a good chunk of at least the first two acts of a novel with the protagonist is the McDonald's holiday pie. I'm just putting that out there. If that's a way you want to expand your brand, McDonald's, I think we could do that. But
290 calories, by the way.
I wanted to bring that up because I know this kind of stuff comes up a lot, whether we're talking about, you know, healthier food choices on Daddy on Board, or, you know, your wife's telling me about the vegan boots she wears over on the trending show.
Right.
Whatever other absurd thing comes up like this. I really do think that this pie, which is delicious, has gone through all of that, right? It is fried, flash frozen, loaded onto a truck, shipped halfway around the world, then rebaked somewhere and you know, probably by unwashed hands, inserted into a cardboard sleeve, and then handed to me, and I love it. Don't ever change, McDonald's. Don't ever change.
I know you were on, and the holiday pie, let's see what it says here. It does exist, but...
Of course.
Of course. I mean, that's how they do all their stuff, right?
Are there YouTube videos of unboxings of holiday pies?
No, but there is a... I'm going to send this to you. There is a photo. I mean, there's a photo of it being taken out of the box. So, yes, there is an unboxing. Now, it's not a video. It's
holiday pie.
Oh, man. No, seriously, last night, remember a few months ago, there was that big New York Times piece about the toxicity of sugar?
Yes, of course,
And so last night, anyway, 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm. News for old people. Go ahead.
And for yours truly. did a whole piece. It was actually hosted by Sanjay Gupta, the doctor.
Oh.
It was his piece. But anyway, he
I thought he was the CEO of Sovereign Bank. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He did a piece on that, and it was pretty fascinating. There's a number of doctors now who are looking at the research behind, and they actually study these individuals, or they put them under like lock and key in a hospital. You know, one of those tests in college that you might agree to make some extra cash?
Yes, I do.
I think you and I both are aware of those. I can only imagine that these are those poor saps, right? They're in there for like a month. They're not allowed to leave this like hospital. And they monitor mm-hmm. every piece of food they give them. They weigh it down to the atom, you know, so they know exactly how much they're getting and exactly what types of food. They scan their bodies. They draw blood every half an hour. And they were studying the effects of having sugary drinks on their brain chemistry and also their blood chemistry. And it was remarkable.
They became telepaths.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to start drinking 32-ounce Dr. Peppers.
I always think about that guy in the Showbiz Pizza Place documentary in the Mountain Dew.
Oh, God. Where he swishes it around his mouth.
Gargles with Mountain Dew. Oh, I love it.
But, yeah, you have to – I'll send you the link to that. You have to watch it. It's like 15 minutes. Really, really enlightening.
Hey, you ever – this occurred earlier today as I was attempting to eat a fruit smoothie or drink one. You ever have a moment like this, and this moment endured? This was not like a quick passing moment, and maybe this has something to do about the onset of age, I don't know. But I also think at times it's the cosmos trying to remind you of how small you are. This is the moment I had. Maybe you had a moment like this that you can convey to the audience, Clayton. Everyone is familiar, of course, with the way that straws are dispensed in restaurants or food courts or things like that, right? They're inside a paper sleeve.
Right.
I could not open the paper sleeve to get the straw out. And I started to think, like, what is wrong with me?
Is it are you arthritic? Like,
well, I am. I have some I don't know that we're going to put this on the grid, but I had some like really sobering news delivered to me today by the people that work at the Jefferson Hand Center here just outside of Philadelphia about my wrist, but that's neither here nor there. That played no role in my like I spent a minute trying to get this straw out. I'm just going, what is wrong with me? Like, have I lost all my strength? Like,
that's bizarre.
Like, did someone come up behind with like the kryptonite? And I was like, which for me is like a block of smelly cheese. Like, I can't get the straw out. And I'm looking around like, is anyone else having trouble with their straw? You know, and I'm thinking, you know, there's various methods, right? You could do the one where you bang it on the table and the straw comes out through the top of the paper.
Right.
I couldn't get it out that way. I'm like, am I going to have to bite it?
Super, was it like titanium paper?
Right, that's what I mean.
Wait a minute, did this happen to you on April Fool's Day?
No, this happened to me today.
Because that would be a good joke. I've heard some good April Fool's jokes, like, you know, like gluing a quarter to the floor in front of a vending machine and set up a camera to see how many people try to pull it off the floor. Maybe like titanium straw paper, and like, right. They have hidden cameras. You're going to wind up on an episode of something, right. Like Ashton Kutcher
I've been
pops
pranked.
Out. Right. That's bizarre. I know there are a couple of things that make me feel old, and it must be age.
Well,
right?
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's one of two things. Like, is this the onset of age? Like, I'm just having a bizarre moment like this? Or is this, like, I sometimes think, like, is this the cosmos saying to us, you are not as significant as you think? That a minute of my day was spent trying to liberate this straw from its paper capture. Like, I could not get it out. And I was almost to the point of like looking for help. We're like, you know, screw this. I'm getting a second straw. Like, you start to think of, you know, I've already walked away, right? Now I'm like 15, 20 paces away. Do I need to go back and get another straw? Because I'm starting to think that rather than the problem being me, the problem is the straw paper.
I wonder, because I've started to do that. There are things I just now, that I'm older, I know I don't want to deal with, right? They're just things, right. I'll just sort of pawn
like
off on my wife.
People is
right.
One.
And I'll just pawn them off on my wife. I know this
like the trending show, yeah.
I noticed this with my dad, right? He just knows he'll get frustrated after a few seconds and then just hand it to my mom, you know, like a bag of chips he can't open
right. That's a great one. That's such a perfect example of that, like the bag of chips you cannot open for some reason, and you know that's how thin that material is, right? Like, why can't you get them out?
Yeah, and so now as I'm older, I'm just like, well, I can't do this. I just can't. What's going on here? You know, I'll just hand it to my wife. So maybe it is an age thing, because as a kid, you know, you'd spend a lot. I'm not handing a bag of chips to anyone to open for me. Right.
Even if you have to overdo it and the chips fly everywhere in the destruction of the bag, you're not about to surrender the bag to someone else for help.
Right. And I think I can see that with the straw paper. I would think that that would be the same thing. Although I think there are things as we age where we just become more aware. You know, there are obviously things that happen to us. For instance, last night I was watching have you seen we watched the end of the Daniel Tosh comedy special, which was very funny. Then we just tuned in. The guy that was up next of this hour comedy special was Kevin Hart. Are you familiar with him?
He's a
black comedian. Very, very funny.
Mm.
And he was talking about his kids. And you know, that kind of humor would have been lost on me.
Sure.
Before, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, there goes a quarter. See if anyone picks it up. But now that I'm, you know, now that I'm old enough and I have a child of my own who's nearly two, the things that he was talking, I couldn't stop laughing.
Mm.
You know, just the way in which kids throw tantrums. They do these like weird arm movements that, you know, normal, you know, and he was demonstrating them. He was doing these whole things about having kids come over to his house, the neighbor's kids, and it's not good if you return the child to the owner of that child in a lesser condition upon which you receive them, a black eye, right. A broken arm, that sort of thing. Like, it's now your responsibility. Mm. Or the way in which dads watch their children, dads don't want to actually have to babysit their kids. He was talking about, he's like, I hate doing it. He's like, this is how dads babysit their kids. We sit there with a cup watching a show, and we listen for noises in the other room. Are you in the toilet? Get out of the toilet, you know. But I wouldn't have found that humor funny until I had kids. It's age, you know.
Of course.
It's like someday I'll probably find that show Men of a Certain Age funny.
Mm.
But I'm not that age yet, so
I don't know that anything with Ray Romano will ever be funny ever. But go ahead.
Or even Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right. I think that's one of the King of Queens are two of the unfunniest shows, and Friends. There's three of them. Friends, King of Queens, and Everybody Loves Raymond. Four. Sex in the City, King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, and the other one that I already forgot.
Yeah. Full House.
Five. There are five.
There are
Fear,
five.
Intimidation.
hey, speaking of funny, I had a chance the other night to, on the HBO Go app, I was sitting in bed and had like a half an hour or 20 minutes to, I was like, I don't want to go to bed yet. And we popped on Life's Too Short.
Oh, wow.
The new Ricky Gervais, Stephen Merchant comedy.
Yes. How did you like it?
It is hilarious.
Hey, you know there's a second season of Idiot Abroad going on, right?
I did hear about that as well. This show, I think they just wrapped up. There's only six episodes, and I guess they're on demand if you have HBO. I don't know how that works. At least on the HBO Go app, they're readily available on your Roku device. And you know, if you have a friend kind enough to share that with you, you can log in and see that stuff. But anyway, last night I watched two episodes now, and they're like a half hour, and they are hilarious. It stars Warwick Davis, who's the he calls himself a dwarf, and he runs a production company or an agency called Dwarfs for Hire.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's one of the most famous little people all around in the Star Wars trilogy, et cetera.
Yeah. Of course, he played one of the Ewoks. He was in the Leprechaun films. He was in Willow, last night I watched an episode with Johnny Depp, and where Johnny Depp is playing a new role as a dwarf, and in an upcoming Tim Burton film called Rumpelstiltskin. It is very, very funny. So he needs to hire a dwarf to study him for a week to see how he like lives and walks and lives his life, and oh, just great. And then the first episode I watched was with Liam Neeson, who wants to start doing comedy. So he comes in and
that whole bit where he's learning improvisational comedy or whatever.
God. Yeah.
Where he keeps going back to AIDS. That's
right.
The best thing ever.
It's very funny. So there's a whole exchange like that with Johnny Depp too in this next film. But you'd think it was about Ricky Gervais. It's not. I mean, it's about Warwick Davis and how he like struggles to find work. He goes to like comic conventions and signs autographs for £25 a pop. And this one family comes up to him and asks, you know, says, my son here has a brain tumor. Would you, you know, he's a big fan. Would you mind signing an autograph for him? He's like, oh, I would. No, that's so tragic. I'd be happy to. And as he's done signing it, he asks for £25.
Mm-hmm. Right on. The convention circuit is rough. No two ways about great. It.
You got
to
check that out. So Life is Short, the new Ricky Gervais comedy. And it's very much like The Office. You know, he's
right.
He's written it sort of from that perspective, that sort of pseudo-documentary style, or an observational sitcom style, I guess, as you would call it. So enjoying right that. Did you see
watch
The Killing?
One episode of... No, I didn't. I didn't see that. But I did see one episode of The New Idiot Abroad.
How is that?
Where the conceit of it this go-around is that, you know... I can't even think of the guy's name.
Carl Pilkington?
Thank you. Carl Pilkington, their beleaguered friend who did not want to do another season of this after having a somewhat disastrous first season. And that is, of course, if you believe that what you're seeing on the screen is real. How much of it is him acting for comic effect, I don't know, because I don't know Carl Pilkington. But
right.
It seems somewhat sincere to me in that he's, always at his wit's end. So this time around, they let him pick where he goes. But the trick is, as he's going along, they always arrange things for him to do that he doesn't want to do. So, one of them was, I think he wanted to see a whale or something like that. So they send him to Alaska, and he gets on the boat thinking he's going out to see a whale, and they're like, no, actually, you're getting in a cage, and we're putting you out with sharks. You know, like... Something bad always happens to Carl in these episodes. And, of course, that's where the humor comes from, is that they're his two more famous and richer friends, you know, organize bad things that happen to him. So this one, which was in Alaska, I believe, and then he actually went up into the Arctic Circle a bit, almost went to the northernmost part of the world, like on the back of a sled or something with some woman. They got him some – one day he had nothing to do, and they arranged for him to tag along – with this guy whose job is, he goes around, because it's so cold where they are, all the sewage is frozen, and it gets put out in buckets. And so he goes around picking up frozen buckets of sewage, you know.
Right.
That was his job for the day. But it does kind of, there's like a limit for that. Like, as amusing as Carl is, like, and the same is true of Ricky Gervais's Office, which really preys on awkward situations.
Right.
You know, that they prolong these really awkward moments to the maximum length you can possibly get out of them so that as a viewer you're as uncomfortable as possible. And that has it is past that point now with An Idiot Abroad, in my opinion. Like, I could no longer watch it. Like, they have gone to too great of lengths to make their friend miserable, and I can no longer tolerate it.
Well, you do have a heart.
Medically speaking, yes.
Right. Yeah. So The Killing premiered Sunday night, and they had a 2-hour. So there was two episodes, not 2 hours. You know, like one episode. So right.
That's how they did it the first time around. Two back-to-back episodes.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Of course, where we left off, thinking that the one police officer might have been in cahoots, and we infuriated a lot of fans of The Killing who, you know, weren't quite sure why they didn't wrap it up. We thought maybe they were going to have one killing per season, perhaps, but no. This
right. The original that it's based on, the Dutch program, was a single season.
Hmm.
So everyone, I think, had just reason to think this was going to be a standalone type thing, but it was an excellent cliffhanger.
Yeah, it really was. And so two episodes aired this week. I haven't watched them yet. I thought, we've been riding the Justified recently. Caught up on a few episodes of that, and I thought that the season finale of Justified was upcoming here for season 3, which has just been fantastic. Season 3, I had some people on Twitter saying they just started watching season 1. I said, boy, are you – it just gets better. I mean, every season just gets better. Sort of like Breaking Bad, you know. I thought that was the case because Timothy Oliphant has popped up on Letterman the other night. He was on Ellen the other day. But someone was saying to me, no, this upcoming episode on Tuesday night is not – is not the season finale of Justified, so I'm excited that it's continuing because it is so good. Really, really good this season. So I haven't caught that. Just finished the Walking Dead season, so that'll free up some time to watch something else now, I guess.
Right, and get caught up on The Price is Right. Hey, there was one last thing I wanted to talk to you about, but you know, before we get to that final thing, there should be that penultimate thing that we talk about. Do you know what I'm thinking about?
Our good friends over at Cobra.
I am thinking about our friends over at Cobra. Do you know what it is that I like about our friends over at Cobra?
Well, that they make fantastic items. gadgets, specifically the eye radar, even the Cobra tag?
Mm-hmm.
Could that
These are things to make your life simpler. The Cobra tag system is a two-way locator. You attach the key fob to your keychain, and then you download the free app onto your smartphone so that if you ever misplace one, you can call the other. You'll never lose your keys and or smartphone again. Although, this is an interesting loophole. You think about this? What if you lost them both at the same time? You know what? I bet you give them a couple months, our friends over at Cobra will solve that, because that's exactly what they do. They're always coming up with some clever new solution. They've also come up with the iRadar system, which makes you a safer and more alert driver by giving you up-to-date information about radar detection, laser detection, and red light cameras, as well as tons of other driving hazard information. Thanks to the free app that gives you a completely customizable dashboard, you can get only the information that you want exactly the way you want it. Especially if you tend to travel by yourself from time to time, as I do. I'm a heavy road tripper. I like to take the Cobra iRadar on the road with me because it keeps me awake late at night. Our friends over at Cobra are always coming up with new electronic innovations. You can find out more about them, watch demo videos, engage in their community over at Cobra.com, and also find lists of great retailers where these and tons of their other industry-leading and award-winning gadgets are available. There is one to simplify your life. Go see Cobra.com.
Indeed. We thank them for their support of this show. So, yeah, there wasn't much else I wanted to talk with you about. I thought, I don't know if you had a chance to, I know you had something.
I did. Yeah, it's getting long in the tooth here. So I wanted to ask this of you, since this recently passed, and it was certainly, based on all the reviews I read, the source of much derision, as the last two have been. You know, WrestleMania was this past weekend.
Oh.
WrestleMania 28.
It's amazing. I didn't know that.
Doesn't just the sound of WrestleMania 28 make you feel old?
That's crazy. When were we watching them? I guess they were like 14?
Not even. We were. No, by then it had passed us by. My favorite WrestleMania is 8, which was headlined by, unbelievably, it should have been Savage and Flair in the main event, but it was Hogan and Sid with the run-in by Papa Shango, followed by the save by the returning Ultimate Warrior. Then you'll remember WrestleMania 9 was outdoors at Caesar's Palace.
Yeah.
The opener of Shawn Michaels and Tatanka was probably the best thing on the show because the Steiners weren't on their game with the head shrinkers, and the main event, which was Bret Hart and Yokozuna for the world title, was not very good and then further tarnished when, if you remember this outrageous moment, after Bret lost the title to Yokozuna, Hogan came out and was like yelling at Mr. Fuji. And this is when, remember Hogan at WrestleMania 9 had that black eye, he had like the stitches, he looked like crap. Was yelling at Mr. Fuji, and Mr. Fuji was like, then get in here and wrestle my Yokozuna right now. Hogan got in the ring, clotheslined him, leg dropped him, and won the title like in 30 seconds.
Right.
And that WrestleMania closed with, I think they had like two people dressed up to be Caesar and Cleopatra at that one.
Right.
They were like out there awarding the belt to Hogan. It was the worst ending to a WrestleMania ever. And then WrestleMania 10 is the last one where I really remember everything up and down the card. And this is what I wanted to pitch to you. If there is one WrestleMania moment that I recall with great fondness, it is this. WrestleMania 10, the opening match tore the house down and Owen pinned his brother Bret. And the fact that Owen won was just like the best thing ever. Like I was so overjoyed that Owen won.
I do remember that, yeah.
And I think part of it, too, was because we were watching this at our friend Gordon's house, and Gordon was such a Bret Hart fan. And he and I were very divided on the brother issue. I was so pro-Owen. And when Owen won the match, I was just delighted. Do you remember you have, like, a WrestleMania moment that sticks out in your mind?
I don't remember too many WrestleManias the way you do. Royal Rumbles always stood out to me.
Yeah, the Rumble was really something special.
I mean, I had fondness those matches. And was that the Royal Rumble when – or where was the famous ladder match?
The Michaels-Ramone ladder
match?
Yeah,
was that just on a Monday Night Raw?
That was WrestleMania 10. No, okay. WrestleMania 10.
Then there it was. That was my that's my favorite match. That's perhaps my favorite match of all time.
Yeah. And you know, that really started a huge trend. Even to this day, now they have like a whole pay-per-view that's tables, ladders, and chairs matches, you know, because that ladder match, that one ladder match between Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon repopularized that match, which had like, you know, that hadn't been popular for years and years and years. And that wasn't it. That match was something else.
That was great. Yeah, so that was WrestleMania, huh? Okay, I thought it might have been the beginning of a Royal Rumble or something. They did a few matches first. At the Royal Rumble, was it just the Royal Rumble?
No, you're right. You know, the first one that I really remember us watching live, as opposed to, like, renting the tape after the fact from West Coast Video, was the Rumble 93. And the opener is the Beverly Brothers and the Steiner Brothers. And this was the Steiners' WWF pay-per-view debut. They'd always previously been with the NWA and WCW. So through the wrestling magazines, you knew the reputation of the Steiner Brothers, but you'd never actually seen them until they, on pay-per-view anyway, until they showed up at Rumble 93. And I know you were in the room for this, because not only were the Beverly Brothers expert at making their opponents look good, the Steiners were on fire. And the finish to that match is the first time I ever saw the Frankensteiner, when he just, you know, jumped up and wrapped his legs around Bo Beverly's head and spiked it into the mat. And that was like a revelation, like watching that go down. And that had other, you know, there were other matches too that preceded Rumble 93. That had an excellent Bret Hart Razor Ramon match. Do you remember this? This was the ending of the Rumble 93, and it was such a womp-womp moment. It came down to the Macho Man and Yokozuna. And the Macho Man does his, you know, his big finishing move was the elbow off the top. Flying elbow drop was Savage's move. But we all know you can't win the Royal Rumble by pinfall, right? Even you and I, like, I don't know how old we were then, we understood that you could not win the Royal Rumble by pinning somebody.
Right, you have to throw them over the top rope. And over the top rope, not just any rope, the top rope.
Over the top rope, and then they later added the caveat, they both feet must touch the floor. That came up later. But Savage does the elbow drop and pins Yokozuna. And even as that's going on, we're all like, no, Randy. No, you know, we're yelling at the TV. Cream soda's being spilled on Gordon's mother's carpet.
Right.
Slices of pizza are flying. We're screaming, no, Macho Man, no. And this is the finish. Do you remember this? Yokozuna kicks out so with such force that he threw Macho Man over the top rope when he kicked out. And that was like, the room fell so flat. Like, we all left with sad faces. Like,
yeah, I mean,
why didn't Randy know?
Or he'd just forgotten. And how did he manage to? We hated Yokozuna.
Right. Yes, absolutely. He was an awesome, awesome heel, because we hated him.
He was the he came in so late in that Royal Rumble. He came in like, what is it, like 30 of them? I think he came in like 27th or 28th or something like that. Way late.
Right.
So you had a lot of stuff going on. He comes in. No one could budge him.
Right. Remember when they all ganged up, like Repo Man and El Matador and a bunch of the other kind of like, you know, you're not winning. They all tried to tried to help get him out all at once, and they couldn't do it.
I remember I think like the next year or 2 years later, I don't remember, but there was like a tie. Wasn't there?
Right. No, you're exactly right. I think that was the very next year. It was Rumble 94. Luger and Bret Hart went out together. And you remember there was all that confusion. And we'd never seen a finish like that before that was disputed with the referees. They were showing the different camera angles, whose feet hit first. And it was also really obvious when they did that. I mean, how difficult must that have been to pull that off perfectly, where they hit the floor at the exact split second together?
Right.
There was clearly one camera angle they weren't showing you, where that would have been the one to show you exactly what had happened, because it was probably impossible, right? Like, there's no way all four of those feet hit the floor at the exact same second. So they're showing all these different camera angles, and yet there's clearly the one camera angle they're not showing you.
They couldn't get it, yeah.
Right, but I do remember that was hot. Those were some tense moments. You remember that one of the referees was trying to raise Luger's hand, and the other one would push it down, and they'd try and raise Bret's hand. That's how they set up WrestleMania 10, where they both got the shot at Yokozuna. Now, you know what's crazy? I remember that like I just watched it this afternoon. I could tell you every finish to everything on WrestleMania 10. I could tell you the way they built it. I could tell you some of the key lines from the promos that built it up. I couldn't tell, other than maybe I could name, just because I read the results this afternoon, I could tell you what happened yesterday on WrestleMania. But no WrestleMania since. Like, they don't resonate like that anymore. And of course, the reason for that is whether
there's no Bob Backlund.
Right, exactly. There's no Bob Backlund spending half the Royal Rumble out on the floor. Right. Who moved the mats? That's illegal. I know you're with me on that one. But like anything like that that stays with you, as wrestling has stayed with me and you know, has corrupted my adulthood, whatever age you discover that at, that is when it is its most magical, you know? Yeah. And that's why, like, that era, WrestleMania 8 through 10, that really resonated with me. And, like, that's not to say I wasn't intrigued to find out what happened over the weekend between The Rock and John Cena. You know, it was The Rock's first match back in God knows how long and all that kind of jazz. But if today you came over and, you know, I hooked up the VCR and we had two tapes. We could watch, WrestleMania 28 that just went down, or we could rewatch WrestleMania 10.
No.
Come on.
Yeah.
Bam Bam and Luna against Doink and Dink. Put that in, Clayton. I've got the cream soda.
Yeah, it's not even a question.
So
I'll bring over the holiday pies.
Please do. Look, we went way too long, but if nothing else, Loyal Egghead Army, I think we still have tons of stuff to talk about on the next Grizz.
I think so too.
So stay tuned. We want you to stay tuned to our podcast.
Indeed, we do. Mike's going to be starting The Walking Dead. And hey, before we go, it just occurred to me, you and I had talked a couple of months ago about doing the next season of Breaking Bad together here on the show.
Mm.
And I think we said early March we were planning on doing that. Well, that maybe has now escaped us, and now we are in April. Yeah. So maybe we should start to consider Breaking Bad season four?
I think so. We will consider it, although off podcast you and I have to talk about a Netflix problem. But that is maybe in the future.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe this week. Have a wonderful first week of April. We'll see you back here next week, everyone.
I know.